From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Private property rights play a critical role in a free society. During a recent speech at NC State University, a national expert explained the U.S. Constitution's role in protecting private property. Another mass school shooting has revived discussion of arming public school teachers and principals. You'll hear from state lawmakers on opposite sides of the issue. State Treasurer Dale Falwell says quick work from his staff helped state government retirees get a tangible benefit from the recent federal tax reform. You'll learn how. And we'll discuss why economic commentators are wrong when they try to link economic growth to inflation. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
More than 6,000 nurse practitioners are licensed in North Carolina. It's a fact that our next guest says should play a key role in the discussion over how to expand access for health care services, particularly in underserved areas of the state. Catherine Restrepo is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Health Care Policy. She joins us now to talk about nurse practitioners. Catherine, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, what are they?
Nurse practitioners, they're known as mid-level providers, so they can treat lots of health care needs for patients in a primary care setting, most practice in a primary care setting, and they really work hand in hand with physicians and other health care providers. And when in this state of health care shortages in certain parts of the state, they can be very instrumental in expanding access to care in rural areas and extending their reach to patients there.
They have training. They're experts in certain things, but they don't have as much training as a registered
nurse. Yes, they don't have nearly as much training
or
clinical education as physicians do.
As physicians.
Right.
Okay, just to be clear.
But they can take care of many primary care needs in a primary care setting.
So legislators are starting to look at the profession of nurse practitioners and thinking these professionals might be able to play a role in what you just mentioned, expanding access, because we know that we have a lot of doctors who are practicing in North Carolina, but Catherine, we still have places where there is a shortage.
Right. I mean, like in over a quarter of counties, you're seeing a shortage in OBGYNs, obstetricians. There are 26 counties don't have one. Dental access, dentists, a lot of them are clustered in Wake County. I think like of the 4,000 dentists in the state, over 1,200 or 2,200 are in Wake County alone. So there are significant disparities in, you know, it's not so much of a supply issue in the state of North Carolina of where healthcare professionals are located, but it's really a maldistribution issue. You know, a lot of them are clustered to where the major hospital systems are. And in the case of nurse practitioners, based on how they can practice in North Carolina is holding them back from maybe going into rural areas.
That gets us into a very interesting situation that you've been writing about at johnlocke.org. Explain the relationship that nurse practitioners are required to have by law with a doctor.
Yes. So if a nurse practitioner is licensed in North Carolina, how they practice, they have to establish a collaborative practice agreement with the physician. And that sort of outlines, you know, how often they'll meet every year, sort of the parameters of their patient population, the types of patients that they'll be managing, and their prescribing authorities. And so in a way, you know, these nurse practitioners they're not tied to where a physician has to be, but they are overseen by a physician for certain things like prescribing authority. And it limits them from maybe locating in a more rural area if they want to. I mean, right now they can with that collaborative practice agreement, but it can be risky because the doctor may not feel comfortable with a nurse practitioner going to a clinic twice a week in a rural area. And if something's beyond her scope, the physician may feel uncomfortable because he's not there at that moment with the nurse practitioner.
Are they collaborating on a regular basis? I mean, is this a traditional manager-supervisor situation like you might have in a different type of workplace?
I'd say it's really general supervision. When you have a nurse practitioner and a physician, you know, they can be working. A nurse practitioner can be employed by a physician's practice, so they can be collaborating all the time, but it's not direct supervision. And that's really the key difference here.
If it's not direct supervision, then what is the reasoning behind this required collaboration with
right.
the doctor?
And that's an excellent question. I mean, regardless of whether you have these collaborative practice agreements or not, nurse practitioners will say that they still will collaborate with physicians. But what ends up happening is that these contracts can be pretty pricey as well. And so say that a nurse practitioner wants to have her own clinic. You know, these contracts can be pretty costly. So, I mean, one source was telling me that a nurse practitioner has her own clinic, but she wanted to bring on another nurse practitioner to grow her clinic. But the contract that she has with a physician is pretty expensive, and so it's preventing her from bringing on that nurse practitioner.
What does all of this mean then to average North Carolinians? I can imagine, for example, Catherine, that we have someone listening to us talk right now who maybe is living in the western part of the state
mm-hmm.
and right now is having to drive a long distance to see a doctor and is hearing us and thinking, hey, wait a second, if there's somebody who's qualified to help me with my basic medical needs, mm-hmm. why can't I have access to that person?
Yeah. And that's the big issue at hand here. And hopefully lawmakers will revisit scope of practice reform. I mean, it's been looked at and debated about for, you know, many legislative sessions now. And right now, 22 states have removed these supervisory agreements, these collaborative practice agreements. And in fact, Arizona, back in 2002, removed their collaborative practice agreement. And within a five-year period, the state tracked the workforce and where it was distributed across the state, among nurse practitioners. And there's been a 73% increase in the number of nurse practitioners serving patients in rural areas of the state. So this is, again, one way. I mean, it's a multifactorial issue of healthcare access in rural areas. You know, there's a lot of factors at play that have contributed to rural areas deteriorating in the types of healthcare infrastructure and providers that are there. But this is certainly one way to help alleviate the issue.
Catherine, many times when we talk about access to care, what I commonly hear is people talk about doctors, 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 and certainly that's an important factor.
Mm-hmm.
They're the most highly skilled, you know,
yes.
doctors, surgeons, et cetera, specialists in the medical field.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard up until now, since you've been writing about this, a lot of talk about other medical professionals that maybe want to do certain things, want to get out there and help people who really need greater access. But why is it that we're talking about this now?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of committees that are going on that are, you know, have been developed, and lawmakers that sit on these committees. There's a committee right now at the legislature called Improving Rural Access to Healthcare in North Carolina. There's another subcommittee on graduate medical education, and that committee's focusing on ways to redirect taxpayer dollars and how they fund certain residency slots. You know, and where are those residency slots? You know, where are those residents in training, those physicians in training, where are they going to practice? Are they going to be in a hospital-based setting, or are they going to go out in a community-based setting in more underserved areas? So there's lots of committees and meetings going on that are happening that are talking about how to bring better rural health care.
I would imagine, Catherine, just like with any really important issue, there's got to be a range of views on this. What have you heard or read in your analysis of
mm-hmm.
this issue from doctors and from other nurses? I mean, what are they thinking about this? Are they thinking it's time to make a change here in North
mm-hmm.
Carolina like other states have, or are there some reservations?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, there's plenty of reservations on this issue. You know, physicians will say, I mean, nurse practitioners will say, and there's lots of evidence out there, not just nurse practitioners that are writing these studies, but there's other organizations that have conducted studies looking at patient quality outcomes of care when care is delivered by a nurse practitioner compared to that of a physician. And for many primary care needs, the quality outcomes are similar. Sometimes there are some studies where patients prefer to be seen by a nurse practitioner compared to a physician. But, you know, physicians will say that you know, they're captain of the ship, you know, they're the team leader with when it comes to team-based care. And that is absolutely true. But when there's limited options in certain parts of the state, you know, this is one way where you can increase supply.
We've been talking with Catherine Restrepo. You can read her analysis of this at johnlock.org. Catherine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Private property rights are critical to a free society. Why? Well, our next guest will help us discuss that topic. Ilya Soman is professor of law at George Mason University, and he recently discussed property rights and the Constitution during a speech at North Carolina State University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So before we get into some current controversies involving property rights, just remind us, why is this such an important issue that people ought to be paying attention to?
For several reasons. First, property rights are an important element of freedom more generally. Without the right to private property, it's hard to have a free society, virtually impossible. It's hard for individual citizens to exercise their autonomy. In addition, development economists have increasingly found that secure property rights are essential to economic growth, particularly in poor nations and also for poor people within our own society as well.
What does our Constitution say about property rights and protecting them?
The Constitution has several provisions protecting property rights. Perhaps the most important is the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment, which says that the government can only take private property for public use and also must pay just compensation. In addition, there is the Due Process Clauses of the Fifth and the Fourteenth Amendment, which ensure that government cannot take away your property without due process of law. Obviously, each of these provisions and their meaning has been the subject of much controversy, but all, I think, properly interpreted do provide significant protection for property rights. There are also other provisions that protect them indirectly.
Has support for private property rights waxed and waned at all over the years?
Definitely. So certainly in the early Republic, protecting property rights was one of the main objectives of the federal Constitution, was one of the reasons why the founders set it up in the first place. Also, while there was a lot of debate over property rights in the 19th century and over the meaning of these provisions that I've just described, still generally speaking, the dominant view in state and federal courts and also among legal experts of that time was that there should be strong judicial protection for property rights. That began to wane in the progressive era in the late 19th and early 20th century. And at least with respect to judicial review by federal courts, it collapsed almost entirely after the New Deal era, beginning from the 1930s to roughly the 40s and into the 50s. There has been somewhat of a revival over the last 30 years, though I think that revival falls short in some places and it's still highly controversial. But overall, there has been a challenge to what used to be the post-New Deal orthodoxy, which said that the judiciary should provide little or no protection for property rights.
That is the voice of Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University. He has discussed property rights in the Constitution during a speech at North Carolina State University. Also, the author of The Grasping Hand, Kelo versus City of New London and the Limits of Eminent Domain. And also, if you are interested in learning a little bit more about eminent domain, one of the people involved in the book, Eminent Domain, A Comparative Perspective. Now, we're talking generally about property rights, but there are also some current controversies involving property rights. What's one of the main ones you're watching right now?
One big one that perhaps many of you have seen in the news is going on in Houston right now. As I think most people know, large parts of Houston were flooded during Hurricane Harvey. But some parts that were spared by the hurricane itself were deliberately flooded by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on the theory that doing so might avoid still greater flooding that might have happened if certain water reservoirs overflowed. But obviously, these people who had their homes or businesses flooded at the behest of the government, deliberately flooded, they're pretty angry about it, is understandable. And they filed large numbers of lawsuits in federal courts, I think dozens of them, arguing that this was a taking of their property by the government and therefore deserves compensation. A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected the Obama administration's somewhat extreme argument that deliberate flooding of property by the government can never be a taking, but the court was somewhat vague under the question of, well, exactly when is deliberate flooding a taking and when it's not. And unfortunately, in the present litigation, the federal government in the Trump administration has taken the position that if the flooding happened only one time, it's never a taking, no compensation. Critics call this the one free flood rule. I think that this doesn't make much sense, and that if the government inflicts severe damage on your property by flooding it, it should be considered a taking. They may have a good reason for doing it, just as they may have a good reason sometimes for taking your property to build a road or some other public facility. But the Constitution, I think, still requires the payment of compensation in such cases. So I think these Houston cases are not only important in themselves, because there are large numbers of people involved, but they will likely set important precedents for future situations like this, because sadly, this probably won't be the last time that the government deliberately floods property.
You're also watching, I understand, another piece of property rights information that deals with the Trump administration and specifically Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
Yes. This relates to the practice of asset forfeiture, which is a technical legal term for a kind of legalized plunder that the government engages in. Basically, if you are investigated or suspected of a crime in many states and also in some federal government programs, the government can seize your property and keep it, even if you yourself are never charged with a crime, much less convicted of one. They can do this on the theory that your property was somehow involved in the crime. Maybe drug dealers used your car to do a drug sale or something of the sort. And in many states, the seizure can occur in such a way that the owners have very little opportunity to challenge it. The government may hold on to it for many months before they can challenge the seizure. And even when you can, the procedures often are stacked against the owners. There have been reform efforts in many states to try to fix this problem. But in recent years, increasingly in those states where reform efforts have cracked down on this practice, both by limiting seizures and also limiting the ability of law enforcement agencies to keep the plunder for themselves. This has been gotten around by the state law enforcement working with the federal government in what is known as equitable sharing. So in technical lingo, the federal government adopts the seizure, and then they distribute some of the loot back to the state law enforcement agencies, thus getting around state law prohibitions. This program was curbed late in the Obama administration, but Attorney General Jeff Sessions reinstated it fully over the summer. In Congress, there are efforts to abolish the Sessions policy. Two amendments that would do this nearly unanimously passed the House of Representatives. They have broad bipartisan support. Both left and right have reasons to be angry about this. The issue is now before the Senate, where it also has some bipartisan support, but obviously it's easier to obstruct bills in the Senate in various ways than in the House. So people interested in this issue, I think, will be watching to see what happens in the Senate.
If people hear the words property rights and their eyes start to glaze over, what would you say to them about, no, you need to pay attention to this. This is important.
property rights structure our lives in many different ways. Whenever you buy a house, whenever you engage in many kinds of transactions, property rights are involved. Moreover, property rights are essential to economic development. That's one of the major functions of major findings of modern development economics. In cities where property rights are severely restricted, it destroys a great deal of wealth, both in this country and abroad, particularly for the poor.
Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Should principals and teachers carry guns on public school campuses? What about professors at colleges? Republican State Representative Larry Pittman recently shared his view.
This goes across the spectrum to me, K-12 and everything. I've offered legislation that would allow for principals who have concealed carry and teachers who have concealed carry with the approval of the principal to carry in the schools. And I'll tell you part of what I'm thinking in all this. I was kind of dismayed to find that there's so many resource officers in schools who are not armed. What's the point? You know, what's the point of having an officer there that's not armed? If I were the kind of person that was go in and shoot up a school or a community college or whatever, that resource officer is the first one I'd take out, you know? And then who's left to defend anybody there until the police get there? And by that time, you got a bunch of people dead. We need to pursue this. We need to allow people with proper training and concealed carry permits to carry on campuses, at least the teachers, at least the professors who are properly trained and permitted should be able to do that. because I love our police. They're great. They do a wonderful job. But they can't be everywhere at once, and the people have a right to defend themselves, and we should pursue this.
Another Republican, State Senator Ronald Rabin, disagrees.
Look, folks, it is all very fine to talk about concealed carry permit people being able to carry weapons for the kinds of things we're talking about. Unless you've been in the chaos of combat and been shot at, that is a slippery slope to be on, and consider it very, very carefully. I have no problem with the SROs having the BLET training or similar training. But in full disclosure, I am obviously a Second Amendment advocate. But you have to be careful when you get into these situations. The best laid plans of mice and men go absolutely awry when you get into chaos. There's no way to figure out who's going to shoot at what, when, where, how, and why. And when you start snapping those rounds off with a handgun, that round can go anywhere because you don't really have time to do all of this neat stuff you're talking about. You're going to start this, and I'll guarantee you, If I were trying to hit Senator Tart, it would go over there and hit the clock in chaos, okay? Just think about that before you come down this road.
You've been listening to contrasting ideas about arming public school teachers and principals or college professors in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors, the recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Most people can expect to see long-term benefits from the recently approved federal tax law, but there's one group that saw almost immediate short-term gains. And here to explain how is Dale Falwell, North Carolina State Treasurer. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me back.
This is something that actually affects hundreds of thousands of people in North Carolina, and it is something that happened almost immediately after the president signed this tax law. Tell us what happened.
Well, a couple of things happened. Number one, your listeners know that as state treasurer, we're in the check delivering business. We spend almost $800 million every 30 days just for the pension, health care, and pharmacy benefit for active and retired state employees. And we had a group of employees in our retirement division who had a goal this year that I wasn't aware of that said that we want to try to get the 1099s out as soon as possible. So they got those out 2 weeks ahead of time. Never that quick in North Carolina history to our retirees. So I made an offhanded remark a week or so after that. I said, what have you been doing lately? This is like the 20th of January. And they said, oh, you'll hear about it soon. And they had taken it upon themselves, which is in our press release, to actually take the tax package that the Congress passed and President Trump signed and actually work with our IT department to implement the lower tax rates. So the $500 million worth of benefit retirement checks that went out last Friday all incorporated the lower tax rates, which resulted in almost $5.8 million of additional money into the hands of our retirees.
Now, this is money that they would eventually be benefiting from anyway, but it was because of the quick work of your staffers mm-hmm. that they got it as soon as they did?
Well, not only did they get it as soon as they did, but if they had paid that based on the rates that will be in existence all of 2018, they would really have to have waited till April of 2019 to get this money back. So this was a big win for our retirees. And it's just another example, as the state treasurer, I'm the keeper of the public purse. And not only do I take that seriously, but a lot of hundreds of hardworking employees that work for us take that seriously also.
Now, you've had a chance after more than a year now in office to see what these workers in your department are doing. Is this commonplace that they're looking for ways to help the people of North Carolina in a way like this or in other ways?
Well, I'm very honored. I've had the experience of working with people at the Division of Employment Security for over 3 years. That was almost 800 employees. The treasurer's office is about half that size. And I know the ability, the creativity, the integrity, the passion of the average state employee. And we're trying to set a culture, Mitch, of figuring out what's right, get it right, and keep it right on behalf of the taxpayers and the participants of these plans. And when doing that, they sort of have to see examples that when they try to do something, when they take the initiative, when they volunteer and raise their hand for the toughest jobs, even without being asked in this particular case, they need to know that the treasurer's going to stand behind them. We all know that people who are really trying hard, me and you included, doesn't always work out the way that we intend it to. But they've seen example after example that I reward integrity, ability, and passion in our department. And they're just super excited in different parts of our agency about how to take care of this. But we have a lot of problems. We have a state health plan that is one of the most bankrupt state health plans in the United States, behind Illinois on a per capita basis, according to some of the research centers. We're paying out benefits to people who didn't deserve them. We're just trying to figure out how to get the benefit to the people that deserve them, make sure the people who don't deserve them don't get those benefits, and set these plans up for the next 10 and 20 years so that they're sustainable, so that the state employee and the taxpayers, who are also state employees, and the General Assembly, as they appropriate money, can have some level of certainty. Because the two topics about how you fund your health care and pension, according to Bill Gates, is going to be the dominant conversation over the next decade and will have the biggest impact on public education in this country going forward, how all of us deal with these unfunded liabilities.
We are chatting with Dale Falwell. Is there anything within the laws or within the way the bureaucracy is set up that thwarts them, that stops them from doing these types of things that are innovative?
Well, occasionally, but it's a great question, and because there's been some press recently about how we're trying to reform our disability system. The North Carolina state employee disability system is broken in all kinds of levels. It's very similar to what I found at DES. It's broken. Those are really two different things. And there's been some negative press regarding how we're dealing with that. And our culture is that we don't get to pick and choose which laws to apply, and we don't get to pick and choose which people to apply them to. And the culture is that when we find injustice, and there's no other word for it, when somebody who deserves these benefits doesn't get them on a correct or timely basis, that's unjust. And when the people who get them who don't deserve them get them, that's unjust also. So what binds us together is not our political party or our genders or what part of the state we're from, all the other things that sort of divide us right now in the grand scheme of things. What brings us together is the fact that the justice associated with figuring out what's right, getting it right, and keeping it right on behalf of the taxpayers in North Carolina.
One of the things that we know that you like to do, as in the case of talking to us on this radio show, is bring attention to things that your workers are doing, like this quick work on applying the federal tax law. How does that help with the culture in the department? Does it make people who might have might not have stepped forward with ideas step forward and say, hey, you know, why don't I try this thing that I've been thinking about for years and years?
Well, it does, and it's getting kind of competitive after two or three of them see their name actually in the press release. And where I'm happiest as state treasurer is when I can push the power away from myself and to the people of the agency. That's where I'm the happiest, is when I can push that power away from me and to them. And it's important to, for your listeners to know that people do not call the treasurer's office to book a cruise. It's normally a life-changing event. Some are really great, and some of them are really sad. Last year, just on the state health plan, we had 181,000 life-changing events just on our state health plan last year. People who had a child, people who have lost a loved one, lost a spouse, got married, lots of other things. So it's important that the culture of our agency is to remember who our customers are. And our job is to make those participants, treat them like customers, and then in some instances, especially regarding the state health plan, is to turn them into watchdogs. That's the most exciting part of what we do.
Bill Falwell, North Carolina State Treasurer, thanks once again for joining us. We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue, more visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read, a new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. With the economy growing strongly, some business commentators are now pushing a narrative that simply turns basic economics on its head. The John Locke Foundation's senior economist, Dr. Roy Cordato, joins us now to explain the faulty economics at play and what we should really know about what's happening with the economy. Roy, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back, Donna.
We're starting to hear a certain phrasing, and that is that the economy is now overheating.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, I would argue it means very little. If what they're implying is that there's too much economic growth.
How is it possible to have too much economic growth?
Well, that's a very good question. In reality, it isn't. I mean, if what you mean by economic growth is more goods and services being produced, more stuff out there that people want, you really can't have too much of it. People's wants are infinite, and we're perfectly willing to consume what's produced. And so the idea that you can have too much of that, and on top of what I argue that that can be causing inflation, really makes a little sense when you understand the idea that the more of any particular good there is, the price of that good is likely to go down. Well, it's the same with true with if you had more of all goods throughout the economy. So when they use this term overheating economy, they have a particular notion of economic growth in mind, which is really something called too much aggregate demand.
Help us understand that.
Well, aggregate demand, it's really no emphasis on the supply side of the economy. It's a notion put forth by what are called Keynesian economics, goes back to the 1930s. And it's what's driven a lot of policy, Obama's stimulus package. I would argue even George Bush's stimulus package. And the idea is that people will demand so many goods and services, and the supply can't keep up with it, and therefore prices will go up. But there's only one way that can happen, right? You have to ask yourself, well, where's the money come from? If people are demanding more goods and services, but they're not producing more goods and services, which is how we all get to typically are able to demand more stuff. We produce more. We work more. Then you have to ask yourself, where's the money come from? And that, because it's that money that drives inflation, and it comes from the Federal Reserve, and and it's their task to manipulate the money supply.
Roy, for those of us who aren't economists like you are, it seems that there's something pretty basic going on here. I thought we all wanted more growth because we wanted more people to be working, more people to be either producing products or providing services. And then on the other end, since more people are working, more people would have money to spend and they'd be out there buying it. I thought that was all a good thing. So how is this somehow turned into something that we need to be concerned about?
Well, your problem, Donna, is that you don't have a PhD in economics.
That's it.
you think about things in common sense ways. The way that gets turned on its head is really, I would argue, not by real traditional economic thinking, not by thinking about economics the way Adam Smith thought about it, the way I would argue a good supply side economists think about it, but the way that has really driven most thinking in macroeconomics and even today, although to a much lesser degree, economics textbooks of certainly 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, this idea that really economic growth is all about demand. People wanting to buy stuff that somehow you can have too little demand or too much demand. And you know, it's the government's job to sort of manipulate demand to get it to be the right amount so you don't have too much inflation or too much unemployment if you have too little demand. So the whole thing is about people demanding stuff. But the fact is that people have no problem wanting to demand stuff, right? We all want more stuff. That's not an issue. The issue really is supply producing and creating incentives to do so. And I would argue that contrary to a lot of these business economists, who I think are really just steeped in this Keynesian way of thinking, that it's really economic growth in the true sense of the word, increased supply in goods and services. And to be quite frank, they've harped on the tax cuts, recent tax cuts, by saying this is going to fuel too much economic growth. This is going to overheat the economy. They really don't understand the nature of these cuts, which is to stimulate the supply side of the economy, not the demand side.
You mentioned the word inflation. Mm-hmm. First of all, help us understand, what is it? Exactly what is inflation? Again, for those of us who aren't economists, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it going to cost us more money?
It's a bad thing. I guess I might take issue with some economists. I think that inflation is an eroding of the purchasing power of our money. Of our revenue, of our incomes, right? It's an overall increase in the prices of goods and services in the economy. Well, what does that mean? It means every dollar in our wallet is worth less. I'm sorry, that's a bad thing.
Right.
And it's generally caused, you know, Milton Friedman is famous for saying that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. What he meant by that is, inflation is caused by really too much money, or another way it's been put is too many dollars chasing too few goods and services, right? Dollars trade against goods and services. The more dollars you have relative to goods and services, the less valuable those dollars are going to be. Simple supply and demand.
Is inflation coming?
Let me just say I'm concerned about that. Not for the reasons that these business commentators say, not because there's too much economic growth, but there's too much monetary growth. Okay. There's too much money and there has been for the last 15 or so years. I mean, all this talk of quantitative easing and interest rates, you know, at zero or slightly above zero. Well, what is all that talk about? Well, it's about the Federal Reserve pumping lots of new money into the economy. And that has had all kinds of bad consequences, over the years. The real estate bubble in 2007, 8, or the bursting of that bubble, was about easy money, meaning, a loose monetary policy, pumping lots of money. Where was that money channeled? Well, it was channeled into real estate markets. Because when the Fed pumps money into the economy, it goes through the banking system, drives down interest rates, and encourages people to borrow. And so there's not a we call this false growth, right? These bubbles, right? That people are overinvesting in things that there's no real demand for.
Lastly, Roy, are things going well right now? I mean, kind of in very basic terms, should we feel positive about the national economy?
I do. By and large, although, like I said, I am concerned about what has happened, with monetary policy over the last 15 years, both under, Federal Reserve, appointed by George Bush, and then really, which was a continuation with Obama, same kinds of policies, afterwards, inflating the currency, and which can have pretty serious effects, like the bubbles.
Dr. Roy Cordato, the senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. Roy, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.